Hello, I'm Tim Bowes. Welcome to the Net Hero podcast, the podcast about net zero. People, places, the things that are going on to change our world. But before we get on to this week's episode, two things to mention. One, our brand new website, futurenetzero.com. Go to it. It's got the tools to help you, particularly our learning and index sections that will really help you get to understand technologies that will help you get to cutting your emissions today. There's plenty more on that platform, including obviously the podcast and lots of great advice and inspiring stories. And the second thing is a date for your diary. The Big Zero Show is back, bigger and better than ever before. July the 2nd and 3rd at the Coventry Business Arena. Day one is all about business, 5 years on from the Net Zero Declaration. And day two is about skills and how young people and older people can reskill. Giving back on day two, making business on day one. It's all part of what we're trying to produce here at Future Net Zero. Now, on to this week's Net Hero podcast. If you look at one of the biggest challenges we have for net zero, it's what we stick in here, the food we eat. How will we get our food greener and cleaner? Now, over the last few years, probably I'd say last 5-6 years, we've heard a lot about veganism and plant-based diets. We've heard a lot about kind of, should we have livestock, artificial meat, all of that. But one of the biggest issues we've got that not enough is talked about is water. The amount of water we use in our agricultural world, the way that we are trying to get to that stage as the population increases, 8 billion, maybe 10 billion by 2045. How will we feed all these people in the lowest carbon way we can? That's one of the things I'm going to discuss today, talking to Jack Farmer, who is a farmer, which is even better, and is a specialist in the whole area of kind of hydroponics, and in particular, a fantastic word, aeroponics, vertical farms you may have heard of. Jack, hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Really good. Let's start at the beginning of this. People have heard of vertical farms, but what exactly are they? If you can describe it to our viewers and listeners, what sort of things are they? Because you get this idea of it's kind of like a bunch of test tubes with little green stalks.
Yeah, sure. That's a good question. So the place I would start, ironically, in explaining a vertical farm is actually in a greenhouse. Because if you imagine in a greenhouse, you have a irrigation system, you often have a lighting system and environmental control, just to make sure your plants are in the right zone.
Yeah.
That's the fundamentals of what you then translate into a vertical farm. So you've taken your greenhouse, you've moved into a warehouse, and you've put it up onto multiple levels. And there's loads of complexity in that, there's loads of automation in that. But that's fundamentally the same thing. With all of those protected cropping environments, you're attempting to keep your plants in an optimal growing window through that environmental control, through that lighting, and through that irrigation. Pretty much that's the goal, and that's how they then look. You're looking at multiple rows of racking and shelving with some LED lights in a glass, in a warehouse unit. Basically, that's what a vertical farm is.
Your company, I think it's called, is it Let Us Grow?
Yep.
So I like that, Let Us Grow. We're out there, or Lettuce Grow, whatever. Terrible jokes, but dad jokes. I'll go into the need in a second, but I just want to get to a bit of the science and get that out of the way. You talk about aeroponic, which means soil-free. Now, that sounds startling to me. So what is aeroponic, and how can a plant grow without soil?
Sure. So, I mean, aeroponics, to explain it, is a form of irrigation. So in any of these systems, you tend to mix your nutrients into a water-based form. So you've got some water with some nutrient feed in there, much like you'd have with most of kind of your gardening or your outdoor irrigation. We then, rather than spray that onto the top of the soil, on top of the plant, hydroponic or aeroponic growers will pipe that to where the roots are sitting. And you're either soaking the rooting, kind of root in it, or what we do is we use very little growing media and have the roots hanging down into an air gap. We then spray that water and nutrients onto the roots directly.
While the roots are in the air?
While the roots are in the air. So I'm a plant biologist by background. The way I would describe this in terms of a horticultural standpoint. So if you can imagine a tropical rainforest, you have a lot of plants that grow in the trees. Epiphytes. And those roots will grow down into the air.
Of course.
Environment. We effectively recreate that in a horticultural setting. And that minimizes the growing media. Often it can make your roots healthier, And also it can then, as a result, it can improve your productivity. So that's where we sit within the irrigation supply chain. We're kind of specialists in that thing.
You said that it obviously has got to hang in something. So if you remove the soil, you talked about a substrate. Can you explain what that is? What is it actually? Because it's got to anchor. The plant can just float around, can't it?
You're totally right. So in all types of these kind of irrigation systems, you will have a substrate to anchor in. Now, historically, with hydroponics, that's been peat. And then they've moved to rock wool and then to coconut fiber. So you can see it's getting more sustainable over time. But what you tend to be using in that scenario is either a plug, which is like a compressed kind of pot, if you like, what you'd see in a bedding plant, or you have a mat. And that's kind of a, let's say, a 250 by 400 centimeter piece of matting. I've seen them made out of loads of materials. But what we would effectively use is one of those different forms, often using kind of a jute-based organic fiber. We'd place the seed in that and let it germinate. Wow. And then what we're really trying to do is get that seed to anchor into the mat. And then almost 2 or 3 days later, when the roots are just poking out the bottom,
yeah,
we then put it straight into our system, because that's when we work, when the roots are exposed.
It sounds crazy because you kind of, it's the thing we've done for millions of years. We stick things in the soil and everyone is talking about soil health and, you know, the amount of topsoil we've got.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a serious way of growing food, suspending it in the air? Because this is where, do you know what I mean? This is the thing that people go, well, that sounds great, but it's kind of lab and it's a test and it might be kind of funky, but could I actually feed a village, a city, using this form of agriculture?
No, it's a really good question. I think that the thing with agriculture is that because it's such a consolidated supply chain, not many people really see how large-scale agriculture works.
No.
It's true of a... Same would be the case in energy. I'm sure it would look very crazy from first principles. But what you've got to understand is that this kind of technology that we deliver is very much building on the kind of shoulders of giants in terms of the glasshouse horticulture industry. Now, that supplies the vast majority of the salad vegetables you'll ever see from Holland, for example.
Yeah,
if you look,
exactly, yeah.
You look at over the next couple of months, you'll start to see Dutch produce filling the shelves. You'll already see Spanish and Moroccan produce that's largely produced in polytunnels and not to a dissimilar fashion. And in the EU, at least, the vast majority of that lettuce and salad that you're eating from particularly the Netherlands is produced in glass houses, on tables, in methods described almost exactly like what I've just described there. What we do is actually we provide kind of an upgrade to those systems, a rolling bench that rolls around that does these things. And we're just an optional add-on, if you like, to those systems. So can it grow a city worth of food? I'd say yes, because it already does, particularly in that kind of leafy greener.
What about these vertical farms? And I think you describe it quite well. How tall are they? And we have filmed them. And if you look at futurenetzero.com, you'll see a couple of images and have a look at the videos. But basically, from what we've seen and when the film crew's gone, they're in these kind of glass boxes. The plants are there. They're sprayed or irrigated. And then they stack them up. But there's got to be a certain height. The ones we've seen have been kind of about 3 meters tall. But how high can they go?
I've seen them up to about 12 to 14 high. I mean, but I think realistically, most people seem to have reached around 6 to 8 meters and are quite happy with that.
Wow.
It comes down to the fact that modern day vertical farms are pretty much automated in terms of how the plants will shuttle in, they'll grow, and then they'll be shuttled out to a preparation area. And there's a kind of a diminishing returns to making it too high because it's then quite hard to service your machinery. So it looks much more like an Ocado kind of factory. It's a distribution center where things have been shuttled around.
Other distributors are available as well.
Yeah, other distributors, of course. Sorry.
Don't worry. That's right. It's we're not the BBC. You can say what you like.
That's fair enough. Okay, great. I'll be very, very biased then. Yeah, in terms of vertical farms, they do have a place in the industry. And obviously, I owe a great debt to that element of the industry because it's how we built Lettuce Grow to start up with. I mean, the reality is, the first thing to understand, it is part of horticulture. It's nothing different, really, fundamentally from the glasshouse industry. Vertical farms tend to work when you have a certain like environmental constraints. So if you don't have enough water, mm-hmm. If it's really hot or really cold, I would argue that vertical farms work very well. And where that tends to be manifested is in the kind of Middle East, the Scandinavian regions, for those two different reasons, because they're more effective than glasshouses in those kind of. And they also work when you have a really long supply chain over winter for certain produce in the UK. So The large vertical farms that are growing in the UK right now are largely focused on herbs and leafy greens. But I'll give you a case study in basil. But the majority of basil out of season in the UK is grown in Tanzania and Kenya and air freighted for the price of around £10 a kilogram.
Which is enormous carbon footprint.
Enormous carbon footprint, and also quite expensive. And that's the key thing. Even if you get down to the economics, £10 a kilogram for basil is quite expensive compared to your £1.50 you're going to get for a lettuce per kilogram. So a vertical farm in that scenario can compete, particularly over winter, in a way a glasshouse can't.
How many vertical farms are there roughly in the UK? Because I just thought these are kind of like one-off weird things. I saw one at COP20, whatever it was, six, I can't remember which one it was, the one in Glasgow. I mean, are there loads of them? Are there dozens? Are there hundreds?
I think it depends on what you categorise them as. There's lots of smaller vertical farms, which are effectively social enterprise projects. But in terms of large players, I'd say there's three or four significant players in the UK market, which is quite consolidated, but it's quite similar to the rest of the growing industry. There's only real, you could probably count in each category on your hand, the top 20 of most growers in each category. Of those, I'd say Jones Food Company, Grow Up, Fisher Farms, they're all producing at reasonable scale at this point in time. And they're really, I know Jones Food, last couple of years have been saying they're providing about 30% of the cut basil production in the UK.
Wow.
A lot of these players are starting to work into that kind of background of the food supply chain. You won't notice it because it's all an own brand with retailers.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Success, that's what success looks like, really.
I'm going to talk about some of the advantages in a minute, but I just wanted to get to what you can grow.
Yeah.
The ones I've seen are exactly what you described, lettuce maybe, or some sort of like chives or things. What can you actually grow in these things?
So again, I'll walk from greenhouses to vertical farms because it gets more niche as you get into vertical farms. Glasshouse production conventionally is used largely for your tomatoes. That's about 50% of the industry.
Yeah.
Cucumbers, courgettes, peppers. And then you have a leafy green category and they'll do all the leafy greens and herbs. You'll also do all of your potting plants, ornamentals, everything for a garden centre, tend to find in a glasshouse. That tends to be all the bigger crops. When you get into vertical farms, they're so expensive that actually you need to be growing crops that have a really fast turnover.
Yeah.
So you can't really be sitting in that system for more than 1 or 2 months. So then you've got herbs and leafy greens. It's kind of how the industry launched itself. I've seen a lot of them propagating trees because they're very effective in propagating. Yeah. And actually a lot of what you see now in modern systems is someone will propagate in a vertical farm and then move it into a glasshouse as it gets bigger. So you kind of this stacking and then outdoors. You also, the growth area of this industry, in my view, is actually going to be in kind of pharmaceuticals.
How do you mean?
Well, there's a lot of interest in terms of parts of the pharmaceutical supply chain, which are starting to grow plant-based vaccines.
Of course,
plant-based kind of proteins. And also you see, actually, funnily enough, I know if there's a farm in France that's growing lily of the valley for perfumes. There's these bits of supply. There's these weird bits of supply chain that often you find are fundamentally inefficient within that kind of food and pharma supply chain. And those parts, that's where vertical farming can work because you can create this isolated niche condition that you allow you to grow lily of the valley in Paris. That kind of thing.
Big foods.
Yeah.
The foods that we fundamentally eat, wheat, rice around the world. Could you grow any of these things? Could you grow tubers like potatoes and carrots and things like that? Where would you say that this wouldn't work?
Yeah, it's a really good point. I can refer to this. If you can't grow it in a greenhouse, you definitely won't grow it in a vertical farm.
Right,
so
okay.
You don't see cereals or potatoes grown in glasshouses. You can grow mini tubers for potatoes in glasshouses, which is kind of cloning. But apart from that, the kind of calorific crops, you need such a large amount of land that actually, why would you want to cover that with steel and glass? It's just more expensive. You just accept your losses on the soil. It's not for everything. Absolutely not.
So it won't be a big, you know, global solution that we'll have our rice grown in these things or, you know, our bread comes from wheat that grows in these things. Unless the technology changes amazingly, but...
Well, this is it. I mean, unless you're in a kind of sci-fi style prepper scenario where everything's really, really in trouble, you can. Of course you can.
Right.
You can do almost... You can grow... Yeah, it's not
fundamentally different to the outside. Yeah, yeah.
But it's just stupidly expensive. And really, the key thing to understand is that this part of the horticulture industry is really focused on salad, nutritious vegetables, or starter materials for other part of farming.
I get it.
That's been the same for the last 40 years, and actually the best way to frame it in your mind.
What are the advantages of growing this stuff? Because I assume, A, you don't have the soil, so that's a pretty big thing. You probably can get away without pesticides because there'll probably be no pests. But there's a cost of the energy, the lighting, the water, all of that. So weigh that up for the listeners, how that all works out.
Sure. So again, two categories. So in terms of glasshouse, historically, they've been powered by gas, big combined heat power plants. And then incrementally over the next 10 to 15 years, you're seeing most new builds transition to electricity. So they've gone from being big suppliers of energy to the grid to big demands of energy from the grid. They were all hit massively by the gas crisis from the war in Ukraine. But as that starts to recede and as we start to see more renewables on the grid, I think what you're seeing there is basically a form of production that is energy dependent, but fundamentally is kind of resilient and a decent proportion of the EU food supply within these categories. Vertical farms have been electrified from day one. So they're very much grid dependent in terms of their climate impact, but also their economic impact.
So if you clean, if you've got clean grid, they're fine. But if you've got a dirty grid,
absolutely. Right. It's like the key thing that the glasshouse industry needs to do is move away from gas. That's clear. And that's either by kind of association with anaerobic digesters, or actually large kind of water facilities is what I'm seeing at the moment, where you can use that kind of water reservoir as a large heat pump. That's what the future glasshouses seem to be looking like. And the Dutch are kind of leading the way on that, with geothermal as well, for heating. So these are the kind of things that you're going to start to see the industry doing. And it's very much within the technological capability of the industry.
I can see everything you've said so far, which kind of makes sense to me. I suppose the thing that doesn't make sense to me is that it seems to me that this would be the preserve of niche food industries, but also fairly wealthy ones. Could these work in sub-Saharan Africa, for example? And I'm not saying that it has to, but I'm just trying to get an idea of where this stuff is. Or is it really about richer Western nations who are consuming more as a way of trying to reduce the footprint? You see what I'm trying to get to?
No, it's a very fair point. Again, I'm only talking about the categories that we operate in here, but I've talked about the higher tech end of the industry. I think the vast majority of the protected growing environment in the worldwide is polytunnel based, and they're much cheaper and much simpler. You've got basically, you're growing in the soil or just outside the soil. You are covered by plastic and metal, and that is the element I haven't spoken about yet, and that's absolutely the biggest growth area in the industry. I think if you look at where all your Moroccan tomatoes are coming from, they're definitely in polytunnels. It's the same with Mexico and the US. It's almost a conveyor, because what you start to see is that if you're a grower, and let's say you're growing in Morocco right now, you're going to be going year on year through droughts, floods.
Of course, exactly. All the climate change things. Absolutely.
All of the climate change things. And actually, that's driving more people undercover. And at the moment, that's plastic and metal, because it just cuts out that eventuality where a freak storm takes out all your fruit. And actually, that's huge. Really is. And it means you can centrally irrigate. So you don't even have to irrigate straight onto the soil. You can drip irrigate as well. So
we've seen that exactly. Yeah, spray a mist into the air. Yeah,
exactly. Right. That is often the unspoken and the cheaper end of the industry. And polytunnel manufacturers are doing a fantastic job in that area. Is that going to ever touch kind of calorific crops? No, and that's fine. It's never intended to do so. What we're talking about here is the kind of nutritious end of the food supply chain. The calorific end of the food supply chain it's a very different game, and that's fine. It's a different part of the industry, really.
Do you think that this technology will principally be sort of, you know, more wealthy nations doing the sort of growing vertically?
Vertical farming, yes, absolutely. Vertical farm is the most expensive of the expensive. Higher tech glass houses, yes, I agree. Polytunnels, no. I think polytunnels is very much going to be ubiquitous worldwide. So it's just the same, basically, it's all the same thing. You're all just trying to control the environment to grow these more precious crops, if you like.
Of course.
But they're just more expensive and more complete ways of doing things up to vertical farming that you can choose from as a grower. And being an irrigation supplier, I'm kind of agnostic to the three, but you can see how there's a continuum there rather than a...
Quick questions for you. Does it increase yield? And also, what do they taste like?
Yeah, good question. So in terms of taste, almost all soft fruit and fruit growers will use something called a Brix meter, which is kind of sweetness and flavor.
Right.
And it really comes down to how good your grower is as to how much it tastes, because what you find in these systems is you're controlling all the inputs. So, and you're controlling all these environments. So depending on how stressed and what you're putting in there, much like a chef, you're controlling what the outcome is. So I've tasted some incredibly good, high quality and fresh and tasty produce coming out of these. I've also tasted some really bad stuff. Often I was growing the bad stuff, actually. But it comes down to the grower.
Because people talk about, you know, the soil, there's the phosphorus or the carbon, whatever it is that the plant absorbs, and certain soils give you certain things. Flip it out, grape people go nuts if it's not in the right soil.
So
are you saying that you can, in this kind of air, no soil scenario, you could create that sort of flavoring by spraying in, say, some phosphorus or whatever it needs, potassium?
Absolutely, yeah. In terms of nutrition, that's very much controllable by the macro and micronutrients you're putting in there. It's also the stress of the plant and making sure that it's not taking up too much water, for example, and that it's converting things to sugars. So it's the same kind of agronomy that you'd have outside. Just obviously what you're doing outside is a bit more lower input. So the soil is an incredible buffer and it's an incredible environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
It enables you to basically put something in the ground and walk away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas you can't do that with this.
You can't do that with the system. So it's more involved, but fundamentally you can aim for the same objective.
And what about yield?
Yield. So yeah, I mean, if you're looking fundamentally at the industry, it is about yield and it's about reducing losses. And that's why people go undercover. And it's why to put a polytunnel on, you're mainly avoiding losses. You might bump your yields a bit. As you go up that curve towards greenhouse and then vertical farms, you're really chasing higher and higher yields, which you just get by keeping your plants safer and happier. And fundamentally, there's a whole body of literature that says that does work. It's just a question of, look, not everyone should or can put a load of money in and build a high-tech glasshouse. It's not right for every scenario. But those yields do track upwards with effectively the fanciness of the system you put in.
What does it do for our net zero targets? How will this help us? And I think what you've done a really good job defending it and also criticizing it and putting it in a very kind of neutral position for people to understand. I think it's got a role to play for sure. But the fundamental question is, they look great, they're efficient, they're robotic, whatever that uses a lot of energy. How will this kind of farming and irrigation help us eventually cut the footprint of agriculture?
No, I appreciate that. This is obviously something that it is something I'm very passionate about as an environmentalist. The way I look at those different elements of the industry is that controlled environment agriculture is never going to be fundamentally net zero. If you're building a structure out of steel,
of course,
it's never going to be...
Same as just digging a few holes and planting it.
Yeah, it's never going to be carbon negative.
No.
And so what you're doing when you're... But for example, you can massively reduce the carbon footprint. So the degree to which your steel is new or a retrofitted use case, and also the energy source that you're using to power your facility and your energy efficiency of your facility will massively impact your carbon footprint. So if we separate it first into two categories, one is the embedded emissions of building the thing, which is separated on almost all kind of impact assessments. And then there's the carbon emissions of growing the produce.
Of growing, yeah, absolutely.
So retailers almost only ever ask about what's the impact of growing the kilogram of produce. That's what they report.
Of course.
They just... All the impact of building the facility sits on the balance sheet of the grower. So if you can see what I mean, it's going to be quite hard for the grower to claim carbon credits. Yeah. Anyway, so if we're looking at the operational emissions, you can massively reduce that by renewable electricity. And that's a trajectory that most kind of richer economies are on. And I think really over the next 20 years, you're going to see the impact per kilogram drop massively as peat gets worked out of the supply chain by 2026. It's going to be banned in the UK, supposedly. Also, as renewables come along. So if we hit a largely electrified renewable grid by 2035, for example, these things are going to be quite low impact. Now, they're not going to be net zero, but you also got to ask, what's the alternative? Mm. If people in the UK want to have tomatoes year round.
Yeah, we should have them here rather than being shipped in, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a question of, if you want year round supply of the majority of produce in supermarkets, it's a game of what's less bad rather than what's net zero. Because fundamentally, tomatoes in the winter in the UK.
It is bad.
Yeah, it's objectively bad. It's
what's of course it is. Bad. Same with lychees and kiwi fruit, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Before we go, I think this is really interesting stuff. Food waste.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that we're terrible at in this country. And I've been guilty of it myself. And I'm trying to make sure our family absolutely only buys what we're going to eat and cooks it and does it. Is there a role for any of this in trying to help reduce food waste? And could you use the food waste? Where would this all fit into that kind of other part? Because we all concentrate on growing, but flipping heck, how much do we waste?
Well, I think, again, it's the food supply chain is a fascinating thing. It's obviously something I'm quite passionate about. And it's important to, I guess, distinguish between waste pre-farm gate and post-farm gate. Now, I couldn't give you exact figures as to where those two things lie. In terms of reducing waste pre-farm gate, shortening supply chains actually does have a big effect because your produce is fresher in reaching its end goal. So you're going to get more shelf life. You're going to lose less in the middle. Yeah. You're not shipping internationally. That can really have an effect. Similarly, you're going to lose less from weather events. So pre-farm gate.
Of course, yeah.
These protective cropping systems work. Post-farm gate, in reality, any large grower is distributing to 80 to 90% of the time, the same people, which is a supermarket distribution center. At that point, it's out of your hands. So I would say pre-farm gate, yes. Post-farm gate, it's probably a different question that we need to be asking.
It's a different question about the consumer end of it. It's us as well, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Consumer and retailer, right? So there's shared responsibility, but until it's on the shelves, you can argue that the consumer has very little impact on them.
What's your vision for Let Us Grow? What do you want to do in the next 5 to 10 years?
Good question. I think fundamentally for us at Let Us Grow, we're trying to work ourselves into kind of a durable position within the greenhouse supply chain. So we license our designs, our technology into the big manufacturers in the space. Often they're Dutch, but sometimes they're not. And we're looking to build a kind of a sustainably motivated, durable company in the space. And I think I'll be super proud of that.
And the idea is to save all growers a significant amount of water and therefore carbon in what they're doing.
Absolutely. So our core focus as irrigation suppliers is pretty much water and carbon. And the way that proportionally links to reduced costs for the grower because they're spending less money on fertilizer, they're getting more out. And that there's a real nice shared alignment there. Keeping focused on that. Really.
100 years from now, mm-hmm. have we got vertical farms sitting on the moon?
Yeah, well, yeah, it would make sense there, to be fair. It's going to be a big shipping cost to get some tomatoes out there.
But the idea of kind of like big, huge domes, like biodomes and things like that, do you think that's a reality? Or we still have fundamentally soil-based agriculture and these sort of technologies will be an adjunct to that? Maybe no one can nail. I don't know.
Well, it's one of those things. Yeah, I would say the technology to grow in space is absolutely there from a hydroponics perspective. It's not...
And it doesn't just involve Matt Damon's poo.
I wouldn't advise doing that. Yeah, I think his food, I'm not sure he's passing his food safety quality.
He's not.
No, I think, so yeah, maybe stick with the hydroponics in that scenario.
No, it's brilliant. I think it's great. I don't think it's sci-fi. I think you're doing a great job. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast this week.
It's a pleasure.
What do you think about this whole idea of vertical farming? I think it's clever. I think it's smart. It has a role to play. And as Jack said, it's not really net zero, but it's about helping us to be aware of where our food comes from and reducing its carbon. Let me know. Get in touch on social media. Drop us a line. nethero@futurenetzero.com and keep subscribing to the podcast. See you next time.
You've just heard the Net Hero podcast from futurenetzero.com. Join us as we help you find ways to cut your carbon footprint as we head towards net zero. Subscribe and follow us on social media. futurenetzero.com. Better business, better planet.